And welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Tuesday, July 21st. I'm your reader, Erin. The first article on the front page, we're still really in the depths of this. COVID-19 outbreak reported at Council Bluffs long-term care facility. Health officials discuss virus in county, by Mike Brownlee. The Iowa Department of Public Health, via the state COVID-19 website, has reported a coronavirus outbreak at Rising Sun Christian Village, 3000 Rising Sun Boulevard. Pottawatomie County Public Health said Monday that the three most recent COVID-19 deaths in the county were among residents, two men and one woman, each 81 years or older. Those deaths were announced by the county on July 8th, Friday and Saturday. In a statement, Rising Sun said 19 residents at Rising Sun have tested positive for COVID-19, the disease caused by the novel coronavirus. All of the residents live in a skilled nursing center. The company said the majority of those infected are asymptomatic. The state website, coronavirus.iowa.gov, listed 24 cases at the facility. Matt Wyant with Pottawatomie County Public Health said that the number includes duplicates. Rising said 11 staff members have tested positive and are unable to return to work until negative tests have been confirmed in coordination with the local health department's guidance. Rising Sun said the first positive case was reported on June 26th after widespread testing days earlier. Rising Sun said testing has been frequent and widespread. Quote, we notified public health officials as required and are following procedures recommended by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Ray Dickinson, chief operating officer and leader of a COVID-19 task force for Rising Sun, parent company Christian Horizons. In the statement, Rising Sun said it continues to, quote, enforce the recommended preventative actions such as visitor restriction, associate screening, social distancing, eliminating all group dining, only conducting individualized engagement activities for skilled nursing residents and implementing all infection control prevention and precautions, end quote. Wyant said, quote, everything that Rising Sun has been doing has been above and beyond to keep the residents they have that are currently positive safe, end quote. Pottawatomie County said its total COVID-19 positive case numbers increased by 24 from Saturday evening to Monday afternoon. The state COVID-19 website listed 923 positive cases around 2:30 p.m. on Monday, up from 899 listed around 6 p.m. on Saturday, the last count reported by the Nonpareil. The site listed two new cases on Monday, 8 on Sunday, and 14 on Saturday. There have been 12,365 tests in the county, according to coronavirus.iowa.gov, for a positive rate of 7.5%. The site listed 696 recoveries in the county. Asked for a summation of virus activity in the county, Wyant said, quote, overall in the county, I would say we're still really in the depths of this, end quote. Wyant said his department continues to work with businesses on precautions and guidance and is also working with area schools on plans for the upcoming school year. Quote, we have to be cautious. Proper hand hygiene, wearing masks, it really does make a difference, he said. The unselfish thing to do is wear a face covering, end quote. Wyant noted, quote, you only have to wear it in times you can't social distance, end quote, noting trips to the store and family gatherings among examples. Quote, along with good health hygiene, that's how we'll be able to defeat this thing, end quote, he said. Statewide, there are 39,108 positive cases out of 419,837 tests for a 9.3% positive rate. The state lists 28,008 recoveries and there have been 797 deaths. Here's a look at numbers in Southwest Iowa based on data from the counties and the state website. Pottawatomie County, 923 cases, 696 recoveries, 12,365 tests, 7.5% of those tests have come back positive, 15 deaths. Mills County, 60 cases, 32 recoveries, 2,320 tests, 2.6%. Harrison County, 70 cases, 51 recoveries, 1,333 tests, 5.3%. Cass County, 30 cases, 28 recoveries, 1,094 tests, 2.7%. Shelby County, 125 cases, 121 recoveries, 1,297 tests, 9.6%. Montgomery County, 20 cases, 14 recoveries, 1,004 tests, 2%, 2 deaths. Monona County, 81 cases, 65 recoveries, 1,021 tests, 7.9%. Crawford County, 689 cases, 645 recoveries, 3,258 tests, 21.1%, 3 deaths. Page County, 32 cases, 20 recoveries, 1,421 tests, 2.3%. Fremont County, 14 cases, 6 recoveries, 516 tests, 2.7%. In Regional Medical Coordination Center Region 4, which includes Pottawatomie, Mills, Harrison, Cass, Crawford, Shelby, Fremont, Montgomery, Page, Adams, Audubon, and Taylor counties, there were 8 patients hospitalized with COVID-19, with 4 in intensive care, both down from the nonpareil's last report on Friday. The region has 212 inpatient beds available, up more than 20 from Friday, 25 intensive care beds available, and 60 ventilators available, both comparable to Friday. There is one hospitalized COVID-19 patient on the ventilator. Our next front page article, Iowa Western Presidential Search on Track by Tim Johnson. Iowa Western Community College's search for a new president is on track, a college official said Monday. Iowa Western President Dan Kinney plans to retire effective December 31st after what will be then 26 and a half years of service. The college's search firm will accept applications until September 9th, according to Brent Siergist, president of the Iowa Western Board of Trustees. He said he did not know how many have been submitted so far. On January 6th, the college announced Kinney's intention to retire effective August 31st. On January 13th, the Board of Trustees voted to engage the Association of Community College Trustees ACCT Searches Group to handle the search for Kinney's successor. After talking to ACCT officials, the board asked Kinney if he would stay until the end of the calendar year to give the college more time to search for a new president, and he agreed. A survey was posted online to collect public responses on what people thought the next president should be like. On June 10th, ACCT search consultant Julie Golder facilitated public forums in Council Bluffs, Harlan, and Clarinda on June 10th to gather input. A 20-member presidential search committee was formed that includes representatives from the Board of Trustees, faculty, staff, administration, the College Foundation, community, and student body. The community developed a presidential profile during its first meeting on June 11th. The Iowa Western Board of Trustees edited the profile and approved it later that day. It was posted on the college's website soon after that and is available for review by members of the public and prospective candidates for the position. ACCT searches will screen applications for the board. The committee will review confidential application packages, interview semifinalists, and recommend finalists to the board for further consideration. The board will interview the final candidates, and all finalists will participate in open forums at Iowa Western, probably in early November. The presidential profile and progress reports on the search can be viewed below the main picture on the homepage of the college's website at iwcc.edu. Our next front page article, Guidance for Masks in Schools Varies Widely Across U.S. by Scott McFidridge of the Associated Press, Des Moines. School districts that plan to reopen classrooms in fall are wrestling with whether to require teachers and students to wear face masks, an issue that has divided urban and rural schools and yielded widely varying guidance. The divide has also taken on political dimensions in Iowa, among other places, where Democratic-leaning cities like Des Moines and Iowa City have required masks to curb the spread of the coronavirus, while smaller, more conservative communities have left the decision to parents. Quote, it's a volatile issue, said Mike McGorry, superintendent in Ottumwa, a district in the state's southeast corner of 4,700 students. Quote, you have to be very sensitive and realize there are lots of perspectives, end quote. McGorry said, It would have been easier if the state health officials had issued specific rules, but since that did not happen, the district gave weight to the state education department's recommendation against a mask requirement. Many states are calling for teachers to wear masks, including Alaska, Connecticut, California, Maine, Massachusetts, New Jersey, New York, Nevada, Ohio, Utah, and Washington. Some will require masks for students. Many other states are leaving the decision to officials. Dr. Rob Murphy, an infectious disease expert at Northwestern University, said from a medical perspective, it should be an easy choice. Wear a mask in school. Schools should take other steps too, including reducing class sizes, limiting contact sports, and screening students and teachers before they enter school buildings, Murphy said. But a first and essential step should be mask requirement, said Murphy, who called the current lack of direction a no plan plan. Quote, this is how ridiculous the whole situation is. It's all over the place, Murphy said. There's a lack of any continuity to this. There's nobody at the wheel, end quote. Even among health experts, there are disagreements. Many districts point to a recommendation by the American Academy of Pediatrics, which urges school officials to encourage but not require face coverings. The organization stresses the need for students to return to school and notes that coverings can impede learning for some children. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has recommended students and teachers wear masks whenever feasible. Other countries where schools have reopened have stopped short of mandating masks for all students. In France, public schools reopened briefly before a summer break with no sign of widespread virus transmission. Masks were only required for upper grades, but students stayed in the same classroom all day. In Norway, nursery schools reopened first, followed by other grades. Children were put in smaller groups that stayed together all day. Masks were not required. Iowa's largely rural Western Dubuque Community School District will let students and their parents choose. Superintendent Rick Kolopitz has heard the arguments for face coverings, but he also hears from people who are opposed. Quote, it's a lose-lose situation, Kolopitz said. We tried to take the political piece out of it, but there's no way to make everyone happy, end quote. Iowa is among many states that have left the mask decision to local school officials. The state education department's recommendation against a mask requirement was based on the idea that a mandate would lead to a host of questions about what face coverings are acceptable, how the rules would be enforced, and what exceptions could be made. Quote, there are just so many things that go into it, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds, a Republican, said in explaining why she opposes a school mask requirement. If somebody wears the same mask for 7 days without appropriately washing it or changing it out, is it actually doing what it's supposed to be doing? Who's going to monitor that? End quote. To Lily Escalason Garcia, president of the National Education Association, the lack of mask requirements and other safety rules is a formula for chaos. Claire Hansen, who teaches 8th grade English in North Liberty, sympathizes with concerns that face coverings would be hard for young children, but think it's still the best option. Quote, do you understand how resilient children are? It's not a mask of terror. They will get through it, end quote, Hansen said. In Connecticut, officials have said they expect to include mask breaks throughout the day, especially for special needs students. Schools also must provide masks for students who don't have one. Casey Barrett said she's worried about how the pandemic's social isolation is affecting her 4-year-old, Harper, who has not been able to play with her friends since March. She said she's concerned about sending her to pre-kindergarten in Old Saybrook, Connecticut, in the fall, but believes her daughter can manage a mask. Quote, it might come off at some point during the day, and as a 4-year-old, she probably will need redirection from the teacher, she said. But then, if she sees other kids taking it off, will she take it off? End quote. Deanna Strethers, whose youngest daughter attends high school in State Center, Iowa, said she understands parents who want to make their own decisions without mandates from the government. Quote, I'm not a big government type of person. I do not like my government telling me that you do not do this or you can't do that, she said. But personally, I think masks are smart, end quote. Our next front page article, Iowa traffic deaths near historic lows, but as state reopens, travel picking up again, by Rod Beauchart, Des Moines. Iowa is on the road to fewer traffic fatalities this year as the coronavirus pandemic slows travel and reduces crashes. which could result in the lowest highway death toll in nearly a century. As of Friday, 130 people this year have died in crashes on Iowa roads, a level down from 35 from the same period last year. For all of 2019, the state recorded 336 traffic fatalities. Dennis Kleen, the State Department of Transportation official who tracks data on highway-related deaths, said March, April, May, and June saw lower death tolls when things were shut down and people were sitting at home. But traffic patterns in July are starting to return to normal as the state reopens since Governor Kim Reynolds eased COVID-19 restrictions. Quote, "There's a lot less traffic," noted Kleen, who said Iowa's highway's fatality count at this point is hovering around historic lows based on data dating to 1925, the only year the annual toll dipped below 300, with 261 deaths that year. Quote, "It's hard to tell what's going to happen," Kleen said, but added, "This might be the year that we could get under 300, end quote. By contrast, Iowa's peak year for traffic deaths was 912 in 1970. Vehicle counts on Iowa roads, streets, and interstates fell by 44% in mid-April compared to with the previous year as much of the state shut down in the pandemic. They have slowly rebuilt since then to near normal but are still lower," said Stuart Anderson, director of Iowa DOT's Planning, Programming, and Model Division. "Truck traffic has fluctuated as well, but generally has stayed steady to slightly higher than previous years, according to Iowa DOT statistics. The number of total vehicle crashes per month was down strikingly since COVID-19 first was confirmed March 8th in Iowa. State records show 2,954 crashes took place in March, compared with 4,031 the year before. By April, the gap was 1,667 lower and 1,563 in May. But June's 3,790 collisions was down less by 864 compared with June 2019's total of 4,604. Jeff Von Brown, team leader of Modeling, Forecasting, and Telemetrics in the Iowa DOT System Planning Bureau, said, quote, "We're definitely seeing a reduction in traffic," end quote, since mid-March compared to last year, with a 60% drop during the Easter Sunday season due in part to the combination of inclement weather and COVID-19 concerns. Quote, "Since that low point, we've only slowly crept our way back up," end quote, he said. Quote, "We've been sitting at about 15 to 20% fewer vehicles on the road for the past 4 or 5 weeks or so. There's a lasting reduction. When will we get back to normal and maybe even positive? It's hard to tell. We're still in a very unclear situation with the pandemic itself, as well as life has changed for a lot of people, working from home and how people feel comfortable about going out," end quote. COVID-19 effects have played havoc with transportation financial norms. State revenue from fuel taxes and vehicle sales has dropped, causing uncertainty for some highway construction plans. The reduced vehicle traffic and safer roads have resulted in some temporary insurance rates rollbacks, but the travel industry is feeling the effects of fewer hotel bookings and car rentals in the midst of what usually is the highest of summer vacation and travel season. Many Americans are still taking a waiting-and-see attitude when it comes to travel, said Mark Peterson, AAA spokesman for the Iowa-Minnesota area. "Many of those plans are being done cautiously and more spur of the moment, according to the association that forecasts Americans would take 700 million trips from July through September, based upon economic indicators that state reopenings that are subject to change." Quote, "That's off about 15%, end quote, Peterson said. "That's the first decline in summer travel since 2009. That comes at a time gas prices are favorable for consumers, averaging $2.20 a gallon nationally and $2.10 in Iowa, which was about 50 cents per gallon lower than last year," he noted. "Car trips remain the favorite mode of transportation," Peterson said, "primarily due to flexibility in schedule and the ability to social distance. The less congested roadways, however, have brought with them an increase in the number of people driving in excess of 100 miles per hour, a 113% spike in the amount of speed citations for 100 miles per hour or greater, and a 70% jump in citations for motorists traveling in excess of 25 miles per hour over the limit prompted Iowa State Patrol officials to join their counterparts from Nebraska, Missouri, Kansas, and Arkansas in launching an enforcement crackdown, along with the good news that diesel tax recipients remain strong with the steady truck traffic. There is bad news. Heavy vehicles take a toll on the condition of the highway system at a time overall transportation funds are down. And our last article on the front page, Bluffs Man Sentenced to Prison on Child Porn Charges by Mike Brownlee. A Council Bluffs man has been sentenced to 7 years in prison on federal child pornography charges. Tate Pillager, 19, was sentenced by U.S. District Court Judge Rebecca Goodgame Ebinger to 84 months in prison for possession of child pornography, according to a release from the Office of U.S. Attorney Mark Kickerbaum. Pillager will serve 10 years of supervised release at the conclusion of his prison term and owes $1,500 in restitution. The charges were the result of an investigation initiated by Facebook, who submitted information to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children that a user of their service uploaded suspected images of child pornography via Facebook Messenger, the release said. The Iowa Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force and local law enforcement investigated the tip and executed 2 search warrants at Council Bluffs homes linked to Pillager. Law enforcement located a computer, cell phones, and flash drives, which were taken as evidence and analyzed, the release said. The forensic analysts revealed Pillager possessed numerous images and videos of child pornography. The investigation was conducted by the Council Bluffs Police Department and prosecuted by the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of Iowa. Moving to the Council Bluffs region page, open seats remain at special ACT test sessions. There are still seats available at 3 special ACT testing sessions in Council Bluffs. There are 7 openings at sessions at 8 a.m. on August 7th and 8 at Dodge Hall at Iowa Western Community College, 2700 College Road, according to a press release from the Iowa Board of Regents. 8 seats remain at the session at 8 a.m. on August 14th at Dodge Hall. To be eligible for the special testing sessions, a student must be an Iowa resident attending an Iowa high school, planning to graduate in winter 2020 or spring 2021, and must be taking the test for the first time. Scores from the special testing sessions will be valid and accepted only by the 3 states of Iowa regent institutions, University of Iowa, Iowa State University, and University of Northern Iowa. Students will be required to bring a photo ID, number 2 pencil, and an admission ticket that may bring an approved calculator. No mechanical pencils, books, dictionaries, highlighters, colored pens, correction fluid, smartwatches, recording or internet devices, cell phones, fitness bands, scratch paper, or tobacco will be allowed. Participants will be screened for fever and other COVID-19 symptoms before entry and must wear facial coverings to the testing site and throughout the exam. The testing fee is $80 per person. For information and to register, go to iowaregents.uiowa.edu/BOR-campus-act. The Council Bluffs office of the Western Iowa Regents Resource Center may be reached at 712-366-3647. Our next article, Council Bluffs Men Sentenced on Cocaine Distribution Charges by Mike Brownlee. 2 Council Bluffs men have been sentenced to federal prison terms for conspiracy to distribute cocaine. Douglas Schlott, 35, and Tyler Alwyn, 21, were sentenced by U.S. District Court Judge Stephanie M. Rose, according to a release from the Office of U.S. Attorney Mark Kirkbaum. Rose was sentenced to almost 6 years in prison for conspiracy to contribute cocaine and possessing a firearm in furtherance of drug trafficking, the release said. Alwyn was sentenced to more than a year in prison after pleading guilty to conspiracy to distribute cocaine. The charges were the result of an investigation initiated by a concerned citizen who provided information to the Council Bluffs Police Department that drugs were being distributed in a parking lot, the release said. An undercover investigation of this information led local law enforcement to execute a search warrant at Schlott's Council Bluffs home, where police located cocaine, drug paraphernalia, and a firearm. This investigation was conducted by the Council Bluffs Police Department and prosecuted by the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of Iowa. Our next article, Annual Sydney Rodeo to Proceed with Some Health Precautions, by Heidi Hertenson, Valley News Today. Fans continue to wonder what the 97th Annual Sydney Championship Rodeo, July 28th through August 1st, will look like this year amid the COVID-19 outbreak. Quote, well, that's probably a good question, said David Magel, Rodeo Board President. It changes every few days. We're just going to follow the guidelines from the state thus far and the county, end quote. Magel said they would keep spectators in the stands to a 50% capacity, enforce social distancing, and have signage available. He said at this time, spectators will not be required to wear masks. Magel said hand sanitizer will be available, and they are considering sanitizing the grandstands daily. Quote, we're going to try and do everything we can to make people feel comfortable being there, said Magel. It takes the effort of the spectators as well as everybody else to follow the guidelines. Magel said the PRCA has its own set of guidelines that will have to be followed as well. He said some of those guidelines include contestants being required to wear masks and sanitizing of the bucking chutes and timed event chutes. At this time, Magel still anticipates vendors being part of the rodeo this year, but is unsure of what their guidelines will look like. Magel said he didn't have a lot of concerns about having the rodeo with COVID-19 still circulating, but encourages everyone to maintain social distancing and good hygiene practices. Quote, I'm sure we'll have some hurdles that we've never had before, said Magel. It's one of those things, if you take a year off, it's pretty hard to recover. It was a tough decision to go forward or just not have it. It's easy not to have it. I guess we'll work through the hurdles to have it, end quote. Magel said the Sydney Championship Rodeo had only been canceled 3 times during the 97 years, and that was during World War II. He said they didn't use the word canceled, however, but instead said postponed. There have been positive feedback on the decision to go forward, Magel said. Quote, the pre-ticket sales have been really good, said Magel, so that's kinda a good sign that people want to get out and get things somewhat back to normal, I guess, end quote. Magel is expecting to have a record number of contestants this year. He said usually there would be 36 rodeos happening in the same time frame as the Sydney Rodeo, but this year there were only 11 taking place, so contestant participation was high at all of the remaining rodeos. Quote, we've got over 800 contestants coming in this year, Magel said. That's the highest number of contestants we've had in history. We've gotten over 400 contestants 5 or 6 times since 1946, but this year is unprecedented, end quote. With that many contestants, some riders will be competing in the nightly rodeos and others will have to compete during the morning slacks hours on July 20th, 8th, 30th, and 31st. Quote, I think we'll have a really good rodeo as long as people can get enough people in here to make it a profit, said Magel. It's kind of an unknown this year, and I hope they relax some of the restrictions, end quote. Something new this year is the grandstand seating will be general admission every night. The board decided not to have reserved seating in the grandstands to help with social distancing measures. The reserved box seating and add-a-box seating will still be available with guidelines being followed. The rodeo performance will be at 8 p.m. and run July 28th through August 1st. There will not be any bands after the Friday and Saturday performances as in years past. Magel said this decision was made before the outbreak of COVID-19. To purchase pre-sale tickets, call the box office at 712-374-2695, 10 a.m. through 4 p.m. Monday through Friday. You are listening to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Tuesday, July 21st on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Dorothy Ann Tiarks. Dorothy Ann Tearx, age 90, entered into internal rest on March 31st, 2020. She was born on July 3rd, 1929, to Lee M. and Helen Charles Gittens, the youngest of three children. She was united in marriage to William M. Bill Tearx, Sr. on December 9th, 1950. To this union, one son was born, William M. Billy or Bill Tearx, Jr. Bunny was preceded in death by her parents, brother Lee Eugene Sonny Gittens, sister-in-law Eva May, sister Helen Arlene, sister Cook, brother-in-law Virgil C., and her husband of 59 years. She is survived by her son, Bill Tearx Jr., daughter-in-law Andrea R. Ivers, granddaughters Jessica J., William V. Billy, and Hillary A. Clinton Jr. Duffy, and was great-grandson Wyatt D. J., as well as a host of nieces, nephews, and friends and neighbors. The memorial service will be held at Holy Kalnoski Funeral Home on Saturday, July 25th, 2020 at 11 a.m. Memorials may be directed to St. John's UCC or Muscular Dystrophy Association. Jesse J. Chu Nunez. Jesse J. Chu Nunez, at age 91, of Omaha, Nebraska, passed away July 19, 2020, in Omaha. Jesse was born January 28, 1929, in Council Bluffs, to the late Caterino and Angela Medarno Nunez, and attended Thomas Jefferson High School. He proudly served his country in the U.S. Air Force from 1948 to 1952 and spent over 30 years working at ASARCO as a lead refiner, retiring in 1992. Jesse was a devoted member of the Catholic faith and is preceded in death by his parents, brothers, and sisters. Survivors include his nieces, Margot Aguilera of Papillon, Nebraska, Elizabeth Aguilera of Omaha, Susan Aguilera Robles of Bellevue, Nebraska, great-nephew Salvador Robles of Bellevue, great-nieces Gabriella Robles and Andrea Robles, both of Omaha, great-nephew and grandson of Chu's, Nicholas Robles of Omaha, and other family members and friends. Rosary, Thursday, July 23rd, 2020, at Our Lady of Guadalupe Church, 23rd and O Street, at 7:30 p.m. Funeral Mass, Friday, July 24th, 2020, at Assumption Church, 5438 South 22nd Street, at 10 a.m., interment at St. Joseph Cemetery with military rites by the Canesville Riders Honors Guard. Due to COVID-19, masks are encouraged. Richard Glenn Dick Beck. Richard Glenn Dick Beck, age 87, of Omaha, Nebraska, passed away July 17, 2020 at Chai Bergen Mercy Hospital in Omaha. Dick was born September 19, 1932 in Council Bluffs to the late Roy G. and Frida Gress Beck and graduated from Abraham Lincoln High School with the class of 1951. He proudly served his country from 1952 to 1956 in the U.S. Air Force, where he was a member of the USAFSS, United States Air Force Security Service. This security service was selected from half of the 1% of top airmen, and their task was to monitor, collect, and interpret military voices and electronic devices from signals from countries of interest. Upon his honorable discharge, Dick worked for Woody's Motor Shop, which he eventually owned and operated for 50-plus years. He will be remembered for his honesty, gentleness, and kindness to all of his customers. He was a longtime member of Faith Lutheran Church, where he previously served as their financial secretary. Dick was preceded in death by his parents, wives Beverly, October 4th, 1989, and Mary Kay, May 17th, 2017. Survivors include son Randy and wife Karen of Council Bluffs, his stepdaughters Jacqueline Mel and husband Mark of Lincoln, Nebraska, Julie Bain and husband John of Vestal, New York, grandchildren River and Kyle Beck, Jared and Mariah Mule, Taylor Bain, sister Susie Brandt and her husband Keith of Seymour, Tennessee, brother David Beck of Independence, Missouri, nieces, nephews, special friend Sue Groupmeyer of Council Bluffs, beloved cat Mushu. Visitation Wednesday, 6 to 8 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home. Funeral Thursday, 10:30 a.m. at Faith Lutheran Church, 2100 South 11th Street, Council Bluffs. Interment Lewis Township Cemetery with military rites at the grave. Box lunch to follow at the Walnut Hill Reception Center. Memorials to Bellevue Senior Center and Autism Society of Nebraska Omaha Support Group. Terry Lee Kozad. Terry Lee Kozad, age 50, passed away July 17, 2020 in Council Bluffs. Terry was born May 7, 1970 in Omaha, Nebraska, and graduated from Thomas Jefferson High School in 1989. He attended Iowa Western and served in the Army Reserves. Terry graduated from the Police Academy in 1998 and joined the Carter Lake, Iowa Police Department. In 1999, Terry joined the Council Bluffs Police Department and received the Medal of Valor in 2006 and Officer of the Year in 2008. He worked at Cabela's in Security Management. He was preceded in death by his father, Carrie L. Kozad, in 2018, and his grandparents, Harold and Doris Christensen. Survivors include his wife, Ashley, of Bellevue, Nebraska, his daughters, Alexis of Bennington, Nebraska, Mackenzie of Fremont, Nebraska, and Natalie of Bellevue, his mother, Janet O'Neill, and husband, Jim, sister, Sherry James, and husband, Jason, all of Council Bluffs, stepmother Lisa Kozad of Underwood, Iowa, half-sister Kristen Kozad of Scranton, Iowa, and half-brother Aaron Kozad of Council Bluffs, stepbrothers Pat and Brandon O'Neill, mother-in-law Patty Moore of Eutin, Nebraska, father-in-law Larry Sias of Omaha, brothers-in-law Matthew Sias of Omaha, Ben Sias of College Springs, Iowa, niece Ireland James, nephews Wyatt and Quentin James. Visitation Thursday, 4 to 8 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home. Funeral service Friday, 10 a.m. also at the funeral home, with live stream available at the Cutler O'Neill website. Click on Terry's obituaries. Interment Ridgewood Cemetery. Memorials to the family preferred. Janet Louise Owen. Janet Louise Owen, age 74, of Council Bluffs, passed away at her home on July 20th, 2020. She was born January 15th, 1946, in Council Bluffs to the late Leonard L. and Juanita Kencht McQuinn. She graduated from Thomas Jefferson High School in 1964. She worked at Altars in Council Bluffs and then did in-home daycare for many years. She went back to work as a lab technician and retired from DCI in Omaha, Nebraska. Janet enjoyed bowling, shopping, and spending time with her family and friends. In addition to her parents, Janet is preceded in death by her husband, Donald Owen Sr., brothers Brian and Leonard, stepson Don Owen Jr., grandson Jacob Robinson. Janet is survived by her children, Ronald Robinson, spouse Marla Smith, Alan Robinson, spouse Shawna Kinnard, Christy Calabro, spouse Tim, Rick Robinson, spouse Trisha, Anita Owen, spouse Nick Mueller, Tammy Patterson, spouse Bob Hyduck, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and many other friends and family. Visitation will be Wednesday, July 22nd, 2020, from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Hoy Kilinowski Funeral Home. Funeral services will be Thursday, July 23rd, 2020 at 10 a.m., also at the funeral home. Interment will be at Memorial Park Cemetery. The family will direct memorials. Moving to the sports section, Iowa football. Iowa officials aware of racial disparity within football program, by Steve Batterson of Quad City Times. Iowa athletics officials were aware of claims of serious racial disparities within the Iowa football program prior to former Hawkeye players sharing their concerns on social media last month. A 9-page report from the UI Athletics Diversity Task Force followed interviews in 2018 with 50 current and former student athletes, coaches, and staff members, and its findings were presented to department administrators in 2019. The university previously released a summary of the report, but the full report obtained by HawkeyeNation.com offered detailed information about issues at the core of the complaints. The report concluded that Black student athletes at Iowa felt they were expected to conform to white culture, targeted for extra drug testing, subjected to verbal harassment and inequitable discipline policies, misunderstood by coaches and white teammates, and misled during the recruiting process about available resources. One unidentified player was quoted in the report as telling the committee, quote, "The white student athletes at Iowa are viewed as the standard that African American student athletes should strive to model themselves after," end quote. Another athlete said, quote, "We are told to focus on one thing only, our sport. Everything else is a distraction, even having significant others. We are told to commit to the team first and only be friends with student athletes," end quote. During a news conference on Thursday, Iowa football coach Kirk Ferentz said he had read the report in its entirety when it was released. As a result, a committee of current players was formed to address issues, and several changes were implemented prior to the 2019 season. Rules restricting hairstyles and wearing of hats and jewelry inside football complex were among those altered. Ferentz said he met with that committee last August and expected to do so again both during a bye week during the 2019 season and again following the season. Neither of the latter two meetings took place. Quote, "I dropped the ball on that," Ferentz said Thursday. "I felt we had a pretty healthy environment, a pretty healthy culture last December. Coming off the field at the Holiday Bowl, I felt pretty good about things. When we left here on March 13th, I felt good about our positioning to start spring practice. A lot of things in the world have changed since then," end quote. Following the allegations raised in June, the subject of an ongoing independent review of the Hawkeye program by the Kansas City-based law firm of Hush Blackwell, Ferentz said he had reread the task force review multiple times. Additional changes has taken place within the football program within recent weeks, including relaxing several long-term team policies and the university parting ways with the strength and conditioning coordinator Chris Doyle, who was the subject of multiple complaints lodged by former players on social media. Iowa Director of Athletics Gary Barta acknowledged the seriousness of the charges in the report during a news conference on June 15th. Our next article in Prep Baseball, AL cruises past DM North, now win 1 win from state, by Patrick Donahue. Patience at the plate keyed Abraham Lincoln's 15-0 victory in 4 innings Monday over Des Moines North at St. Albert High School in the Class 4A Sub-State 8 semifinal. The Lynx drew 8 walks and had 6 hit batters, leading to plenty of base runners and scoring opportunities. They plated 5 runs in the first, then blew the game open with a 10-run third inning. And they did it all with only 2 hits in the game. Quote, "We were patient today," AL coach Brett Elm said. "We made them throw strikes, and they didn't throw strikes, so we took advantage of the walks," end quote. Ben Fitcher picked up the win for the Lynx, scattering 3 hits on the mound. Last Friday against Lewis Central, the Lynx were down to their final 3 outs, facing a 3-run deficit. In the 5 innings they've played since, they've outscored the opposition 21-0, and now they're just 1 win from qualifying for the 4A state tournament. They'll get that chance Wednesday at number 2 Ankeny. Quote, "We've got some work to do tomorrow to practice to get us physically and mentally prepared to be ready to play Ankeny," Elam said. "Anybody can beat anybody, and I've seen crazier things happen. Last Friday was a prime example for us." Our next article in Prep Athletics, staying power. Mark Royer has enjoyed a long career as both coach referee, by Patrick Donahue. When Mark Royer accepts a challenge, his commitment is enduring. The most striking examples come in soccer and basketball. Royer has been part of the Thomas Jefferson girls soccer program for 33 years, the last 23 as head coach. He also spent the last 23 years molding himself into one of the more relied upon prep basketball referees in the state. Originally from Council Bluffs, Royer attended Hoover and Kern before attending Abraham Lincoln High School, then went to Iowa Western for a couple of years before entering the working world, prior to taking his current job as a para at Thomas Jefferson High School, he held a summer of positions. He worked at Dodge Riverside Golf Course before starting a job as a night stalker at a grocery store in Omaha. Although he held different jobs over the years, Royer always had a special place in his heart for the game of soccer. Quote, "I lived right across the street from AL, the third house down," and he said, "We had a couple parents in the neighborhood that played. We had a team in my neighborhood that ended up being a bunch of AL and St. Albert guys. One dad and mom coached us forever. We were taught young, and we walked down to Valley View Park to practice and in people's backyards. That's where the love of it went. You had all your buddies in the neighborhood. You all played soccer together in every sport. It was one of my favorites," end quote. Soccer was not yet a varsity-sanctioned sport when Royer attended AL. It was a club sport, and area teams, including some from Omaha, competed for what was known as the Xenon Cup, which functioned similar to a state championship. The love of being on the pitch and competing paved the way for Royer's coaching career. Over the course of his time at TJ, the Yellow Jackets qualified for the state tournament in 2003 in addition to playing in 13 regional finals. Competing in those games illustrates how much Royer's players have brought into his coaching philosophies over the years. Quote, "We've had tons of opportunities," Royer said. "It's just one thing or another. Most of them were against the Des Moines Powers in the suburbs. It's a different monster. Sioux City North was the other one that we could never get by." Quote, "It's cliche, but I'm blessed with the kids that I've been fortunate enough to have play with their parents and administration. I've had awesome athletic directors and great principals. They believe in what you do," end quote. Royer appreciates and has borrowed some motivating techniques from coaches who trained him. Quote, "I had great coaches," Royer said. "I was probably coached up to be a better player than I probably should have been, to be honest. I try to do the same thing. I try to take the kid I have and make them better than they think they can be. It's worked. You put a chip on their shoulder, and down there, the chip is pretty big because they want to compete. They want to be respected, and they want the same as everybody else. It's been a tough road, but it's been a real enjoyable," end quote. In addition to soccer, Royer recently finished a 21-year career as an assistant softball coach at Omaha Westside. All that experience in coaching world led to a natural transition to basketball refereeing. Quote, "I think anybody who officiates should coach first, or vice versa," Royer said. "You get a better perspective on what you're doing and what you're trying to accomplish. A lot of people nowadays don't always see the other side very well. Everybody seems to take it personal, and it's not, but it sure feels like it is, though," end quote. Over the course of 23 years, he went from learning the finer points of being an effective basketball official to one that is now routinely finds himself in Des Moines for both the boys and girls state basketball tournaments. He's been to 18 straight boy tournaments and has overseen 13 girls tournaments. This past March, he officiated championship games for both girls and boys tournaments. He has no plans of stopping anytime soon. "It's great being with your buddies and traveling," Royer said. "The big thing is the friends you meet and the people you see." And now moving to the Iowa and national page. "Virus Spreads Leaves Iowa Bar Owners in Difficult Position" by Katie Akin of the Des Moines Register, Des Moines. Jamie Spores drove over an hour to get COVID-19 test last week. An employee at his Waukee bar, Kenny's Garage, tested positive for the novel coronavirus, prompting Spores to close the bars, tell the rest of his staff to get tested, and make an appointment himself. "Test Iowa didn't have any slots open until early next week," he said, "so we found a clinic in Creston instead. It could be more than a week before enough staff members test negative that he can reopen the bar." Quote, "It's definitely closing in," Spores told Des Moines Register. "You know, the last 3 weeks, I've gotten more people that I know personally that have been in contact or exposed," end quote. Kenny's Garage is one of many Iowa bars that have temporarily closed after employees or patrons tested positive for the coronavirus. The hallmarks of a night out, drinking, talking, dancing, have proven to be particularly effective ways for the virus to spread, especially among unmasked indoor patrons. While no Iowa bars have been tied directly to outbreaks, disproportionate numbers of people under 40 were testing positive for the novel coronavirus as early as July. Spores said customers of all ages were casual about the virus, but he'd especially noticed the younger, later night crowd not taking social distancing as seriously. Governor Kim Reynolds said in a press conference that she may consider imposing more restrictions on bars linked to COVID-19 outbreaks. Quote, when we do the contact tracing, if we're seeing a lot of them, a lot of the increase due to bars, then maybe we need to take a look at the hours. Maybe we need to take a look at rolling back some of the mitigation efforts on bars, end quote, Reynolds told reporters. As cases rise in Iowa and across the U.S., bar owners find themselves facing a dilemma, whether to stay open or with precautions, potentially risking the health of their customers and staff, or close until the yet unknown time when risks decline and possibly face losing their business. As of late June, the state lifted nearly all mandatory restrictions on bars. Tables must be spread at least 6 feet apart, which often limits the capacity, and every customer must have a seat, limiting mingling around common areas at the bar. Beyond that, the June 25th order from Reynolds requires bars and restaurants only to implement responsible measures to maintain social distancing, clean frequently, and follow any guidance from public health officials. Spores said staff at Kenny's Garage had been following the guidelines. He also required staff members to wear masks, a practice recommended by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, but not mandatory in Iowa. Quote, to be honest, I'm not sure what else I can do and to stay open at the same time, Spores said. It is impossible to say how many infections can be traced back to Iowa bars. Businesses are not required to close temporarily or to public report when employee tests positive for COVID-19. They may never know how many customers have carried the virus into or out of their doors. Several other states have reinstated restrictions on bars as COVID-19 cases rise. In Florida, bars may no longer serve alcohol. Texas bars are closed entirely, allowed only to sell drinks to go. In Michigan, a bar in East Lansing, home of Michigan State University, closed after being tied to almost 200 coronavirus cases. And bars in sections of South Carolina, Nevada, and Washington State are under new restrictions. In an interview with Reuters, Dr. Jared Baton, vice dean of the School of Public Health at the University of Washington, called some of the bar reopenings an unmitigated disaster. Spores said he expects Reynolds at some point will have to reimpose restrictions on Iowa bars. Quote, if I was a betting man, I would say that would probably happen soon, he said. But I don't have any suggestion on what she should do. I don't have any idea, end quote. While waiting for an action, if any, from the state, bar owners have taken their own precautions to stem the virus's spread. Many, like Kenny's Garage, have closed temporarily after employees or customers tested positive. Full Court Press, a restaurant group that owns over a dozen bars and restaurants around the Des Moines metro, closed downtown's El Bait Shop and adjacent High Life Lounge in June after an employee may have been infected with the virus. Its Buzzard Billy's Bar and Restaurant, also downtown, closed over the 4th of July weekend after employees tested positive. And this week, its University Library Cafe, a popular hangout for Drake students and faculty, closed for the same reason. Quote, I think we're going to just have to deal with it case by case, end quote, Full Court Press owner Jeff Browning said in June after El Bait Shop closed. In the meantime, some bars are imposing additional restrictions on their customers. The Ingersoll Tap on Ingersoll Avenue in Des Moines, which was temporarily closed after a visitor to the bar tested positive, and Lua Brewing Co. in Sherman Hill neighborhood require customers to wear masks when they aren't actively drinking. Quote, if we can slow the spread down, then there's less of a chance we'll have to close again, said Lua co-owner Scott Selix. It seems like if all bars and restaurants required masks, we might have a better shot at not seeing another shutdown, end quote. Along with requiring customers to wear masks when it's not at their table, Lua is limiting seating to 50% of capacity, offering curbside service, and sanitizing all surfaces. Employees are required to wear masks at all times. other Iowa bar owners have decided to shut down voluntarily. Jason Zeman closed his three Iowa City bars, Studio 13, the Yacht Club, and EDEN Lounge, for at least a few weeks after seeing an uptick in Johnson County cases and hearing that coronavirus-positive people were going out drinking, despite recommendations that they self-quarantine for 2 weeks. Quote, "We have bills, such as rent, insurance, etc., that don't stop because we are closed," Zerman wrote in a June 25th Facebook post. "There is no leadership from the state government, and they've purposefully tied the hands of our local leaders to make decisions," end quote. Sports considered closing Kenny's Garage longer term, but he was unsure he'd be able to get government assistance to support his business and his employees. The closure also might affect future business, he said. For the face of the day, Colin Lilly is always ready for his next chance to compete. Lilly, 15, was born and raised in Omaha, but his family moved to Council Bluffs 4 years ago. He attended St. Stephen the Martyr Catholic School across the river before moving, and he has been to St. Albert Catholic Schools ever since. Lilly will be a high school sophomore this fall. He said he has enjoyed growing up in private schools, noting a sense of tightly knit community. Quote, "I just like the small school feeling," he said. "We're all family here. It's a community," end quote. Lilly is a dedicated athlete participating in cross country, track, and basketball. He's a distance runner, making him a good candidate for cross country and the longer track events. Last week, he was seen at an open gym session at St. Albert, where he was getting ready to scrimmage other teams in hoops. He said he is eager for more opportunities on the field and court as he advances through his high school career. He said his goal, like many others in his shoes, is to make it some state tournaments along the way to represent his school and city while competing at the highest level. Lilly has had a busy summer as AAU basketball tournaments have recently started back up following months of inactivity due to the impact of COVID-19. He said he mainly plays at the Iowa West Fieldhouse and has enjoyed competing against teams from all over. When he's not on the court, Lilly has been enjoying trips to his grandparents' place at Lake Panorama for some family time and fishing. And that does it for today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Tuesday, July 21st. I'm your reader, Erin. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. As always, thank you so much for listening and have a great day.